The topic of Padmasambhava, generally known as Padmasambhava, very endearingly referred to as Guru Rinpoche, which literally translated would be precious jewel, who is heavy with compassion and wisdom. Someone who is so much embodying wisdom and compassion that he is sort of just overladen with that those qualities. Such a precious jewel is then the term Guru Rinpoche that he is more referred to by Tibetan Buddhist practitioners. There are many names, Pema Sambhava, Pema Jungne, the Lotus Bond, Padmakara, many, many different forms, as well as what is very popularly known, and many of you are familiar with, the eight manifestations of Padmasambhava, which have eight particular names to relate to. So his life, his whole life, his biography itself gets very complicated. Some people find it fairly straightforward if they have a kind of a unique mind, not only unique, but an eccentric mind, so to speak. In a very kind of a polite way, we say crazy wisdom mind. Otherwise, it's like an eccentric professor's kind of a mind, if you look at that. So some might find it easy. On the other hand, just because of how we approach what is called biography, what is called autobiography, or what is called history, the life of Padmasambhava isn't as straightforward as what we usually think of when we think of other teachers, when we think of Shakyamuni Buddha, for example. So when it comes to Shakyamuni Buddha, we find a very nice, structured life. He lived up to over 80 years. He was born in time. He grew up in time. He studied well. He married well. He had these great visions. He saw all these remarkable things. He had a change of mind. He left home. He went through the penance. He attained enlightenment. He turned the wheel of the Dharma, and he died as a normal person would die. And so it's easy to say 2,500 years ago, such a person then transmitted the teachings which became the basis of Buddhist doctrine, Buddhist philosophy. And at the age of 81, 83, in some cases, he passed away. And so since then, the disciples or his heart sons, the arahats and the bodhisattvas and the great masters have continued his teachings. In the context of, and there's one biography of Shakyamuni Buddha. So when people begin to learn Buddhism, they become very familiar with the life and the inspiring life, as well as the great teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha. When it comes to Padmasambhava, we begin immediately with what his students have written, that in general, there are supposed to be 9,999 different biographies of Padmasambhava. When I grew up, and I was reading some of the biographies, and you go through the life of Padmasambhava, I remember thinking, it's just humanly not possible to do the things that he did in his lifetime, even if he lived up to over 150 years. So I remember going to my teacher, His Holiness Trichin Rinpoche, and asking him, how is it possible that he did all these things? Is it really true? And Rinpoche said, yes, it is very true, and it is possible. Why is it not possible? He lived 3,600 years. So when I talk about a complex way of approaching biography or the life of Padmasambhava, this is what I mean. We find him emanating in many different ways. We find him living for very long periods of time. Over 50 years alone, he lived in Tibet. But prior to that, there is the whole event in Odiana. There are all the events in India, in Nepal, in Bhutan. If you go to Southeast Asia, you'll find hardly any place that was not touched by the blessings and the teachings of Guru Rinpoche of Padmasambhava. So, however, on the other hand, when we look at the time frame, when we look at the historical events, it does get into becoming a little bit complicated for our mind, a mind that is very sort of structured in terms of what empirical history is, to actually make sort of bring a balance between what we are saying. Now, on the other hand, Padmasambhava or Guru Rinpoche's life in the West, also, I think in some cases today, for example, with the immense number of teachings and guidance and Dhamma centers and materials that are available, again, some of you may not be struggling with this topic. But I remember coming earlier, Jatunla and I, when we came to United States and Canada, and there were several topics similar to Guru Rinpoche and his life. And I remember very clearly meeting several people, women particularly, who seemingly had a lot of difficulty with Guru Rinpoche, with Padmasambhava. The whole point was, I remember a good friend of mine said to me very directly, I have difficulty in generating devotion to Padmasambhava because he had five wives, or many wives, five primary wives, for example. There are anecdotes in the Padmasambhava's life where they talk about him accidentally or with intent, in some bios, killing a minister's son, and then because taking that as a reason to abdicate. And people find it very difficult. Why would a bodhisattva called the second Buddha, to whom the Tibetans revere and see as the embodiment of the Buddha from where the Buddhism began in Tibet, would have to kill someone? Didn't he find another way, like Shakyamuni Buddha? He could have just escaped in the middle of the night. Or if he was able to perform lots of miracles, he could have put everybody to sleep and then left the country or abandoned his kingdom. Why did he have to kill someone? So that's very difficult for them to understand. Another objection that I often hear is about performing miracles and magic. And now most Buddhists in the West, for example, when you began to have access to the Buddhist teachings, there was a lot of emphasis given on compassion, on wisdom, on the nature of emptiness, and seeing things as they truly are, which sort of resonates much more to an intelligent mind that is looking for logic in approaching enlightened understanding. Now, when it comes to rituals, when it comes to miracles, when it comes to magic, there's immediately in many minds, not all, but many minds, apprehension. Apprehension that comes because you don't want to be stuck in a culture of theism. You do not want to really undertake something that looks very shamanistic, something that is all about extraordinary things that you don't understand is not your culture. So many people think, well, that's all Tibetan culture. That's the Mongolian culture. That's the influence of the Bon culture from Mongolia. So there's a lot of hesitation. Rituals, unless a person is very differently inclined, in most Western practitioners, rituals is something that you are not comfortable with, something that you all like to pay tickets to go and watch, but not necessarily want to actually embody and cultivate, because you think, how does this relate to my becoming a kinder person? Can I not just be kinder by working with my mind? Why would I have to ring bells? Why would I have to do chants? Why would I have to meditate on a nine-headed deity who has horns and is blue in color? Isn't it? So in those ways where there is the hesitation of the mind, then again, the mystical myth as well as the miracles and the magic that is in abundance in the biography of Padmasambhava begins to bring people into, I think, what can be slotted into some characteristics, sort of some category. One category is an absolute fascination for the extraordinary. So there are some people who are very fascinated with magic, very fascinated with miracles. Say, supposing you're someone who would love to have five wives. Then, you know, you think, okay, there's a tradition there that says this is the way to enlightenment. This is something that is good. So there are some people who have distorted this as well as manipulated the teachings to use it in a very mundane way. Second category of people who are absolutely petrified, who are very, very apprehensive about those kind of things because you think this is all just very worldly. It has nothing to do with enlightened mind as the way it has first been taught by the Buddha. And not only in the West, but this was very prevalent in India. This was very prevalent in all traditions, wherever Buddhism went into, even in Tibet. And then there is another category where people just shut themselves from even trying to understand this. And therefore they think, yes, it's probably right. I just haven't met someone who's explained it. And therefore, something that I'm going to stay away until I know what is happening. So there is a sense of trying to find balance, which is, I think, what most Buddhists do in the West, is that they have respect enough to not be bewildered, petrified, apprehensive, or jump into it in a distorted way. But at the same time, you do not really relate to it very comfortably either. So therefore, you hang on with the Mahayana teachings, and you hang on with the Lojong slogans, and then the teachings on Shamatha and Vipassana. So there is this whole bulk. If you look at what Buddhism is today, there's a whole bulk. It's almost like a railway platform. Sometimes I see it as that, that you need to catch a train to get to a destination. But because you're so much unsure about what train you're getting into, you're just waiting on the platform. And that I call the Shamatha, Vipassana, Lojong platform. And so that's where all of the wonderful teachings, and of course I'm not saying that these teachings are not complete in its own. If one is able to approach these teachings really as it should be, they are complete teachings. However, on the other hand, you must agree that human mind is not that simple. You never know where the ego's manipulating agendas will seep in. And therefore, you are hanging on there. And so now, pretty soon, what I'm finding is that the platform is getting very crowded. You know, there's very little space to move around because there's so many there. So I thought, why not start in Santa Fe, Padmasambhava? Let's see where this one goes into. Now, that was one reason, was Peter Lieberson's, and sort of seeing his teachings continue here. Second is because of the importance of understanding Padmasambhava and his teachings, which is very, very important for all who wish to engage in Vajrayana Buddhism. And then the third, I think, in terms of really working with one's own self, then the teachings of Padmasambhava should lead into really internalizing Buddhism, so that one is not only trying to intellectualize the teachings and the meditation. I don't know if Rinchen La is able to be here. Is Rinchen here? No, you're here. And Rinchen, wife of Peter Lieberson, I just met her. She just arrived today. And if I may share that analogy of Tsongsar Khenpo Rinpoche, which you told me, which I thought was very perfect. And she was telling me that Tsongsar Khenpo Rinpoche, whom she just met a few days ago, told her that if there were anyone who hesitated with Vajrayana Buddhism, I'll say Vajrayana Buddhism here, because of the rituals and what Vajrayana actually entails, then such a person would be similar to a pure American trying to open a Mexican restaurant. So I thought that was a wonderful analogy that only Khenpo Rinpoche could come up with, I think, is really. But that's very true, because what we are pointing out is, you know the substance. You know which spice goes where. You know how it is to be done. You know how it looks like. But then there is an actualization, embodying the teachings, being able to really free oneself from the confinements of a mind that is very ego-based, but will often approach our own awareness as if it is the most logical mind. So the question here would be is, what are we calling logical mind? Particularly, that question has to be put to people who put a lot of emphasis on everything has to fit into my mind's understanding that is very stubbornly going to maintain the importance of common sense and logic, something that can be examined, something that can be proven, something that can be understood. But what's the basis that demands it? And we find that often the basis that demands logic is the most illogical mind that is dominated by ego. Because it's asking the ocean to fit the cup, oftentimes. So we all say, yes, what's the truth? For example, let's take the first thing. Magic and miracles, because this is very abundant, as I said, in Padmasambhava's life. For example, did he live 3,600 years? Yes, he did live 3,600 years. And why not? If we can realistically live 60 years, then why not someone can live 3,600 years? And then we would say, but where is a person other than this one, Padmasambhava, who lived and can be proven to be alive after 3,600 years? So that's the point where we are arguing, which makes it a complicated subject to approach. Because if you approach it from that perspective of prove it as I see it, prove it so that my senses are actually satisfied with the answer, then the Padmasambhava's life becomes full of miracle, full of magic. And therefore, I think the tendency to see the life of Padmasambhava more allegorically or more as a mythical figure becomes very, very prevalent. But if you look at it from the perspective of, let's go back to the same, what I sometimes jokingly call, because it proves what I'm trying to say, it proves the point, but it is a very disrespectful way to say it, so I'm going to beg forgiveness for that. But let's see Padmasambhava as a non-vegetarian. And in contrast to that, I will refer to Buddha as a vegetarian figure. So now if we look at it from a vegetarian Buddha's perspective and his teachings, then what did the Buddha teach? The Buddha's whole teaching, all of the 84,000 tenet teachings of Shakyamuni Buddhas, comes down to a single emphasis, and that is to know the reality of everything as it is, which is called the fundamental truth. Now remember, not my truth, not your truth, not the Buddhist truth, not the Buddhist truth, not the non-Buddhist truth. But what Shakyamuni Buddha taught was, discover the fundamental true nature of reality as it is. The whole emphasis of the journey of meditation or anything that today has become Buddhism is targeted and oriented towards how we can discipline our own mind and its ability to analyze and examine, to bringing it to a heightened potential of realizing true nature as it is. The reasoning the Buddha gave was to point out the resultant state of suffering and chaos and confusion that we create. And since focusing upon the resultant state, it becomes, the resultant state of suffering, it becomes very clear why we should try to find the true state, the fundamental truth. So it's not just because the Buddha said, we don't have anything to do, let's go and find the fundamental truth. Why he did emphasize this was so that look at suffering, look at the chaos, look at, particularly, here I would like to say, suffering can also be said as unnatural behavior. So most of us, if we examine closely, behave very unnatural to our own fundamental nature. We would like it, but we don't do it. We don't want to do it, but we do it. That's unnatural enough. You want to see happiness everywhere? Who starts? You don't want to see the mess anywhere? Nobody cares. A person cannot approach another person without doubt. That's unnatural. That we every day live without exploding this world itself is a miracle, isn't it? So in those ways of referring and seeing and examining, this is then in Buddhism called resultant state of chaos, confusion, and suffering that we have created. Where does it come from? It comes because we're all creating it, and that's the law of causality, or what is in Buddhism called karma. Constant continuum, ceaseless continuum of actions that are collectively created, that then becomes the resultant state of experience that you and I share. But then the root of it would be is, well, it has to come from somewhere. It has to come from somewhere, and hopefully where it comes from is sane. Because eventually every one of us seem to be looking for some peace, some goodness, some happiness. But when we explore, then we find that yes, where it comes from seems to be a fairly good mind that wakes up every day, puts the toothbrush in the mouth thinking, I'm going to have a good day. What happens after that? That is also very indicative of, well, something's going wrong. Things do not happen as you planned it to be. Where is that that shifts the gear from a hope and an aspiration for goodness, and then the sort of resultant state of a adverse or exact opposite of what our aspirations are? At what point does it happen? A simple example would be is every day we wake up, possibly to do something constructive or good. When we look back each day, we find so many moments passed when you were not even aware of what you started the day with, the aspiration that you started the day with. So an intelligent person would then begin to question, is there something wrong here? Is there something wrong in the sense is that where there is the intelligent mind that knows to have a result, a cause must be there. How and what are we driven by that makes us so blinded to this fact that what we do doesn't seem to always correspond with what we want? And so in that way, the essence of the Buddhist teachings and the philosophy becomes simply pointed towards discovering true nature, your own mind, and the way the things are, perhaps broadening your understanding of how things really function, so that in understanding this better, exploring this concept better, that we would perhaps find the possibility of a state of resultant state that would be in accord with what we aspire to achieve. So Buddha's teaching, the Bodhisattvas have gathered it in a beautiful sentence: if you want happiness, you create cause of happiness. If you do not want suffering, you do not create causes of suffering. Very straightforward, very poignant, very profound. Then we find, yes, that's a very simple logic. But why does it become so difficult to do it? What makes it so very difficult to do it? And therefore here, because we see the discrepancy between what we hope and what we actually do, it becomes necessary to say, well, who's the master here? What is it, or who is it, that is dictating our actions of body, speech, and mind that separates the aspiration, the hope, with what it actually does? What makes it very different? And therefore, the whole journey of the 84,000 tenets, the Buddha's teachings, goes into what is then called trying to see what is the true nature of things as they truly are, so that this leads to a better, more constructive relationship with things as they arise, with things as they truly are. For example, we always talk about, let's say, the law of a country, the justice system. When we talk about the justice system, we always talk about really trying to see the whole situation from both the perspectives, the prosecutors and the defendants. And by listening to everyone's story, by seeing all the facts, then trying to figure out what exactly happened. That approach is considered legal. That is called justice. Now, in our own day-to-day life, do we cultivate the same kind of justice to the things that we relate to? Because eventually, each one of us are going to come up with a judgment. The judgment comes in the form of, I like it, I do not like it, I'm too busy to even bother about it. Three judgments that we hand out every moment. All of our senses are directed towards the judgment that is being passed on. But in doing so, yes, everybody has the right to pass the judgment. You are free to like who you like. You're free to dislike who you don't like. You're free to be ignorant and indifferent, however long you would like. But does that then not raise the question how linear your perspective is? How lazy we have become to such a degree that we don't even try to listen to both the parties? To be able to say, I like this, you are taking that out from a whole lot of others. Is that justified? Is your opinion and your judgment not so dominated by discrimination and by bias? And then we say, yes, it is dominated by bias. It is a very discriminating mind. So discriminating, so biased, that it has cultivated a deep affinity and familiarity with linear ways of thinking. And what brings about this linear perspective and this sort of laziness and this sort of quick judgment is simply because of convenience. And it is convenient to whom? That is then temporarily called ego. or self-cherishing mind. What is self-cherishing? Ego is a lazy, insecure mind that dictates constantly its demands and its expectations. Giving into it, we go around hungrily, passing judgments, liking, disliking all the time. And we never cease to creating tremendous amount of causes. And since what are the causes are dominated by self-cherishing, discriminating, partial agendas, of course the resultant state is going to be greater friction, greater dislike, greater hope, greater fear, greater apprehension. That breeds suspicion. Where the suspicion and the doubt is strong in human mind, we behave very unnaturally. And that unnaturalness is what brings the greatest amount of suffering and is the cause, root cause of pain, of hurt, of suffering. So when one begins to approach in this way, the Buddha then says, for in order to be able to break free from this kind of a pattern, it will require each individual to begin to look at things more clearly so that you appreciate the wholeness of everything. It would be similar to a person who would walk into a garden and you say, what a beautiful garden. But then the same mind that would appreciate not only the beauty of the flowers, but the work that went behind it, the manure, the earth, the where it is, the owners, the workers, the seed, where it originated from. If one is able to develop a mind that actually saw the coming together, the compositeness, the compounded effort of everything, and you coached and trained your mind to have that kind of a pervasive view that held everything, gave credit to everything that participated in the coming together of experiences, of moments, then that would be a much more cultivation of what is called a vaster perspective, the opposite of a linear perspective. This vast perspective is called compassion. Kindness, bodhicitta, compassion, seeing emptiness, these are different philosophical terms. What it really means is cultivating a mind that holds everything, is able to appreciate everything in its coming together, in its compoundedness. Where it is able to do it, then you find there is no ground for discrimination at all. Whom would you give more credit? Whom would you give lesser credit to? And then we find the unnaturalness of such a statement as, I like you, I don't like you. Or saying, you know, sort of, this is better, that is worst. How would we posit a concept such as beauty against ugliness? A mind that is able to appreciate the compoundedness of all realities begins to then have an understanding that there is equal participation in the buildup of ugliness as there is for beauty. And if one were to go in terms of the beauty and the marvelousness of the coming together, how could we select something as having more work input than the others? And so compassion, the tolerance, the ability to find sameness, the ground of sameness between all, and what in Vajrayana later is called one taste, arises as a way of breaking through the very sort of unnatural discursive way or the linear ways of looking at things. Now, in order to cultivate this, in order to be able to understand the compoundedness, one thing that the Buddha said is most important is to give it time. You must give yourself time to actually see the coming together of everything. And so in that regard, the Buddhist teachings begin with what is called the very important factor in the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, which is called the first three nidanas of the 12 nidanas that are there. In total, 12 interdependent origination. But oftentimes, if you look at just the first four, for example, name and form is the fourth nidana or the fourth interdependent link. After name and form, we immediately come into senses, contact, grasping, craving, and then sort of the becoming and the birth, old age, and so forth. Those are the resultant states. So without going into the resultant states, if I come back to just the fourth, which would be the beginning of the concept, which then is important because that is the basis of our discriminating mind. To say I like you, you must have a name and you must have given it a form. But name and form originates from the third nidana, which is the consciousness, the mind. If the mind itself did not create a form, did not come up with a name, with a label, then there would be no production of concepts. Now, in the context of the Buddha's teachings, the focus then primarily goes into the first three of these. Basic ignorance is the first, karmic formation is the second, and consciousness is the third. At the level of consciousness, in the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, Buddha explains the teachings as having two stages, a resultant consciousness and a causal consciousness. Resultant consciousness is said to be all the different impacts of actions that we do each day. Physical actions, verbal actions, mental actions, a continuum of many different kinds of actions that we do, which are ceaseless, and then impact our mind because it keeps on propelling. It keeps on asking you to repeat that action again and again. Those are dominated by resultant consciousnesses. But each of the resultant consciousness does add up to a small database called the causal consciousness. So it's almost like a program where the data is collected. So each action that we do repeatedly stores some amount of its seed at the causal consciousness level, such that that dormant causal consciousness is familiar with repetitions of the same kind of action. So every time you say, I like, it receives the message that you are liking things. Every time you say you dislike, it repeats and it agrees. And it's familiar with that kind of a message. And that dormant state of the causal consciousness can wake up at any time to explode into greater resultant consciousnesses. So in the question, in the context of our dying, our experiences of this life are mostly propelled by resultant consciousness. What we're busy with each day doing many things and which are called karma are basically mostly resultant consciousnesses. This dies with the body. When the body dies and then the rebirth, the question of rebirth, how do you connect back to the same familiar habitual patterns are then explained in the Buddhist philosophy as connecting back to the causal consciousness that has retained the same kind of data. And the data is, however, not very refined. It is, however, very, very gross in that it is familiar with very gross emotions of liking, disliking, and the indifference that is there. And therefore, no matter what form you come back in, you still have desire. And therefore, you like things. You still have natural aggression. There is still dislike. There is basic laziness and ignorance. The indifference is a very familiar habit. So when that is conditionally always being formed, the mind is always being impacted, it consolidates the second nidana, karmic formation. Difference between the first two nidanas is ignorance is sort of shifting away from your own basic fundamental nature. Karmic formation is sustaining that state of shifting away from your basic nature. But the nourishment for that is the causal consciousness. And so every repetition of our actions, everything that we are doing, the karma that we consolidate, feeds the karmic formation. And therefore, it sustains and propels you to be sustaining the moving away from your own basic nature. So the Buddha's teaching says, as long as you are preoccupied with the neurosis of likes and dislikes, of the discrimination that is happening in your mind, if that is entertaining, if it's always keeping you entertained, your attention will be shifted more towards the production of the entertainment, and therefore the basic nature becomes something that you forget, something that you are more and more distant with. It isn't that it isn't within your own self, but it becomes something that you are less familiar with because you're not concentrating on your own basic nature. So therefore, the whole aspect of the Buddhist training comes into breaking free from a mind that is biased, that is discriminating. And thereby, through that sort of destruction of the karma that feeds the causal consciousness, one may have more clarity to look at what your real basic nature is. This basic nature can be called the enlightened mind. Enlightened mind, Buddha nature, your own true nature, if it is realized, then it is said from the Buddhist teachings that the construction of all fabricated discriminations would immediately fall apart. And in order to do so, the Hinayanists, or the practitioners that maintain the first turning of the wheel of Dharma as the complete teachings of the Buddha, begin to then take on this instruction by trying to really remain aware of the fundamental nature of one's own mind, the basic nature that doesn't respond or gets attracted or be seduced by the habitual patterns that arises in the form of discrimination. Unnecessary discrimination, which is very interesting, very attractive, very interesting. And the worst thing is you're so familiar with it that it's like one of those, very non-useful, useless thing that you have, but at the same time you're so familiar with it that you don't want to give it away. So habitual patterns are like that. So in order to do so, some people go into deep seclusion. That is where meditators go to isolated places. They go into stages of renunciation. They isolate themselves. They seclude the mind. They train themselves so that they are not brought into the familiarities of the seduction of that which then again entangles their mind into many different kind of discursivenesses. So that is then where in the Buddhist teachings you find a lot of emphasis given to discipline, to ethical conduct, becoming monks and nuns, becoming retreatants, going far away into seclusion, isolation. That's a way of practicing. Now, however, in secluding, now if one takes oneself for the example, you go to an isolated place, you try to stay in a place giving yourself a lot of chances, a lot of space and time to really train the mind not to be attracted, not to be seduced into familiar habitual discursive patterns. You do so, and as many, many great meditators have experienced, yes, mind becomes more familiar with its own clear nature, a nature that doesn't discern, that doesn't discriminate. There is no bias, there is no partiality, begins to really see how all discursivenesses are just sustenance of the ego-grasping mind. And if one were to let it be, that there would be nothing but pervasive resilience, tolerance, and ability to hold compassionately things as they truly are. But does the ego give up that easily? Doesn't. Some are very successful, and therefore there are such levels of realization which are called arhats. Arhats simply mean those who defeat all adversities of the discursive tendencies. So that's a great achievement. There are also many unsuccessful people like ourselves who've shaved head, gone to become a nun. Everything in terms of isolating your mind doesn't help, doesn't work. Why so? It's because it becomes rigid, it becomes tight. It becomes tight because, yes, somewhere you know that this is not necessary to do. Anger is not necessary. Arrogance is not necessary. Jealousy is not necessary. Selfishness is not necessary. But mind races away. And so the Mahayana teachings say that's because you do know, but you haven't actually understood the true nature of phenomena as well as the true nature of your mind. So the build-up of the second turning of the wheel of Dharma of Buddha's teachings, which are called the Prajnaparamita teachings, are further elaboration. Not that the first turning is inadequately explained. It is complete. But for people who don't get it, then the kindness of the Buddha in again expounding it in what we sometimes think is a vocabulary for the common people, in terms of speaking to people whose minds are so hesitant in giving up the familiarity. I've always explained this with my favorite example is old shoes, you know, old shoes that are torn, and you know, you get a heel ache, your knees pain, your heel aches because it's so old. You go out, you buy a new pair of shoes, you wear it for a little while, you get blisters on your feet, you take it out, you wear the old shoes. You know where it's bumpy, you know where it's going to hurt, you know you're going to again go to bed with a bad heel, but you don't get blisters. So same kind of a pattern happens with, you know you don't need anger, you know you don't need to be jealous or ignorant or have selfishness or attachments. But like that old shoe, these are familiar things. You can still go to bed with a blister, but you know that you have great comfort in having given in to the habitual tendencies. So the Mahayana teaching's entire emphasis is in working with such a mind. Therefore, a lot of the teachings emphasizes looking at the reality of phenomena. And here, mind and looking at the nature of mind translates or is changed to the state, sort of sentence that is used or the statement that is used is exploring the reality, the true nature of phenomena. Outer phenomena and understanding what its true nature is. Inner phenomena, the mind and understanding what it truly is. So when through the Mahayana teachings, particularly the Madhyamika teachings, one begins to see what is the true nature of any phenomena, whatever I think is real, exploring the compoundedness of that reality. Likewise, my mind, that teaching and the methods of meditation and examination leads to a resultant state, which is then usually called realizing emptiness nature. Emptiness basis of both the inner phenomena and the outer phenomena. That kind of a realization, if it is again accurate, truthful, and genuine, then there is enlightenment. There's nothing beyond that. To go beyond that is not necessary. Now, again, if I take myself as an example, Mahayana fails. I understand the nature of emptiness of all trees and pillars and vases and table. I know the compoundedness. I can give long talks on the compoundedness of the emptiness of the phenomena. I also know mind cannot be found. I've been looking for it for 43 years. I haven't found it. It is emptiness in nature. But then, if somebody comes and drinks half a glass of this water, leaves it on my table, am I going to drink it? I won't. Because it's not clean. It's been drunk by somebody else. This is a concept. What I'm pointing to is concept. Let me make it easy for some who might drink. So I know Tibetans have great this thing about not drinking something or eating something which is a harsa, left over by somebody else. Now maybe you don't have that concept. So I'll use another one. If someone came and wanted my watch, let's say, this watch is a gift from my sister, Jatunda. So, is it empty in nature? Somebody asks, yes, it's empty in nature. So of course it's empty in nature. All compounded phenomena are empty in nature. Is my attachment to it empty in nature? Of course it's empty in nature. Mind is empty in nature. Attachment is just a thought. Thought is like a wisp of smoke that goes into the expanse of emptiness. Can I have it? No. Now when the mind gets stuck with that, it has an understanding, an intellectual understanding. There is tremendous respect, a lot of devotion. There is a lot of perseverance. There's a lot of agreeing and having confidence in the philosophy. But beneath all of that, there is the actualization that's missing. The question is, when do we begin to actualize a philosophy that we all agree is the absolute truth? Now here then, the great masters of Vajrayana tradition step in and begin to say, yes, perhaps it may be good, as in the tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, especially the Nyingma tradition says, it may be good to say there is two branches of the Mahayana, an outer Mahayana teaching that works with a progressive stage of transformation. And there is also another aspect called the secret Mahayana that will focus upon actualization of the philosophy that you're actually believing in. And what's that belief that you have? Is the fundamental nature of emptiness of things, that they appear but are inherently empty. What appears as form in phenomena is empty. What appears as sounds, as tastes, as texture is empty. What arises as thoughts, emotions, sensations, and feelings is empty in nature. That's the philosophy. Now let's live a life in accordance to that belief. Then here is what Vajrayana Buddhism comes into. The question is, how do you actualize such a profound philosophy? And in actualizing it, should we attempt to actualize it, what are the number of concepts we would have to let go of? Then we find you actually can't hold a concept simultaneously holding a view of emptiness. Yes, things are empty in nature, but my watch. Things are appearances, projections of my own mind. My sister gave me this watch. So this is the contradictory that comes, with which then a much more sort of a severe and a sterner approach to coming into a point where you have to decide this way or that way. And then that's, of course, very frightening for all of us. Because we think, I bartered for agreeing with the philosophy and thought perhaps an exception can be there, where agreeing with the philosophy could lead me to also obtaining the full result. But in actually stepping forward to leap off all grounds of familiarity that are comforting to my mind, logical mind, mind that loves common sense, I did not bargain for that. At least I'm not ready for it now. Many of us who've jumped nevertheless or sort of been pushed into Vajrayana think, well, since it's almost a choiceless, you've now taken empowerments, you've received Vajrayana transmission, so we all think, well, I'm going to do it completely when I retire. When there are all the concepts give up on me, then perhaps I will be able to then actualize. And so that kind of a sort of reflection, when you look into a mirror and you can really see your reflection clearly, that kind of an honest reflection is given to us by the Vajrayana teachings. It just shows us the immense hypocrisy that we bring into a theoretical belief of a very profound view, that which is very beautiful, very picturesque. But in terms of actualizing it, we still succumb to the seduction of familiar patterns of a discursive mind. We're very happy with our suffering. We're very happy with the complaints of the suffering. Itty-bitty little ways of Mahayana compassion and Lojong training makes us feel good. You breathe in all the bad things and you breathe out all the good things and you give lights here and there and you sort of go onto your Twitters and Facebook and blogs about may compassion spread everywhere and peace be everywhere and sanity prevail, you know. But my watch, that's my watch, it's my watch. I need to keep that my watch. So in relating to Padmasambhava, one comes to this point, is that Padmasambhava's life, if seen from a mind that is so stuck with familiar patterns, is always going to look, either you'll have to think of it as a fantastic life that the Tibetans come up with, or you'll have to just say it's very allegorical, it's very much probably something symbolic, something that probably happens, or you just have to keep it in the realm of extraordinariness. Padmasambhava's whole life begins with him being a Padmakara, the lotus-born. So it is said that in terms of, again, the emanation of Padmasambhava, he is the heart essence. I'll get to that later, but he is said to have emanated from the heart of Amitabha Buddha. Indrabodhi, one of the great kings of Udayana, came up to a moment in his life where his son, his only son, an heir to the throne, had died. And he went to consult with a great saint, and the saint told him that if he actually gave generously to all the poor people and really thought about the well-being of the suffering of the people, he would surely again have a son. And so Indra Bodhi is said to have opened up his treasury and given away everything and became completely poor, having lost everything, given away everything, but the lineup of all the poor people still were remaining. And so it is said that he went in search of what is called the wish-fulfilling jewel that would then, if you supplicate to, would give you an abundance of whatever you wish for. And his vision, his hope was that through obtaining the wish-fulfilling jewel, he would be able to satisfy the needs of all the people who were still looking to him to receiving sort of money or whatever it is that would satisfy their needs at that moment. So the story leads to Indra Bodhi going in search of the wish-fulfilling jewel, and on his return, finding in the middle of the Dhanakosha lake, Padmaskara or Padmasambhava, as an 8-year-old lotus born, spontaneously arisen, surrounded by the Dakinis, if you want. Very beautiful picture. Now, Indra Bodhi is said to have asked the question, and that's one of the first remarkable things in the history or the life of Padmasambhava. Who are you, he says. And he says, who are you? Who's your father? Who's your mother? And this 8-year-old boy, Padmasambhava, responded by saying, my father is primordial awareness. My mother is basic space as it is. My lineage is the union of awareness and skillful means. My sustenance, discursive thoughts, false concepts, and fabrications. My destiny to benefit all sentient beings. So that's the start of Padmasambhava. So in that way, we also talk about the birth. Now, again, for some people who think, how can you be born? I found a beautiful piece of written teachings of, I think, Kenzo Rinpoche, Dengo Kenzo Rinpoche, where he had said, some people think being born out of a lotus is a very important point in the life of Padmasambhava, but it is not. If people see that as the reference of their belief or disbelief, then it is like putting enough importance, giving as much importance to a mushroom. Because mushrooms are also born spontaneously, isn't it? So there's nothing fantastic about the point of being lotus born. Point of Padmasambhava is not being lotus born, but after that, what he did for humankind. Did he live up to what he said was his destiny? Did he actually become somebody who looked like the sun of basic space and primordial awareness? Throughout his life, how many beings did he benefit? That is the reference point for our veneration to the life of Padmasambhava, not the fact that he was spontaneously arisen from the lotus. Then again, Rinpoche says, yes, if that seems to, the fact that he was born from spontaneously from a lotus is inspiring to some people, that's very good. That's very nice. But on the other hand, if they think that alone is important, then that is a very false way of approaching. To support this, I read another thing that Trungpa Rinpoche taught many years ago. I think in conjunction to His Holiness Kamapa's coming to, for the first time, to the West, and Trungpa Rinpoche teaching the Westerners of that time, where many of you were there, I think some of you were there, how to actually look at devotion. And explaining the difference between blind faith and resistance to devotion, the intellectualization of the view. And the beautiful analogy that he gave was, anyone who allowed oneself to dwell in blind faith, such as what Kenzo Rinpoche explained as taking the lotus born as the reference of their devotion, as their veneration, that's blind faith. So Trungpa Rinpoche says, blind faith is like that person who has a cow who gives abundant milk, but is so pleased at the fact that he has a cow with abundant milk that he's just very complacent about that fact and doesn't milk the cow. But he's just very happy in the fact that he has a nice cow. On the other hand, Trungpa Rinpoche says, a person who has only an intellectualization of the view with no nurturing devotion, with no understanding of actualization of the practice, is like the person who may have the same cow, but only milks it at one's own convenience. And then he follows it up, Trungpa Rinpoche follows it up by saying, change that to a vending machine in today's time. So where you take a coin, you put in and you get a Coca-Cola or whatever it is that comes out from the vending machine, you then give the coin to a teacher and you get the teaching as is convenient to you, whatever suits your mind. So both of these two, if you take the analogies of these wonderful, great teachers, both of whom were Padmasambhava of our times, if you take that, one would then begin to say that that whole concept of the birth of Padmasambhava itself requires us to immediately balance within our own minds a sense of truly being able to free from all extremes of positing, extremes of what can be real, extremes of what can't be real. Fundamentally, if everything is a projection of one's own mind, then one must be able to rest the mind beyond the extremes of positing, non-positing, of belief, of disbelief. There has to be, if one truly wants enlightenment, there truly has to be liberation. And liberation is not oneself being liberated from the others. Liberation is liberating everything else from the dominance of how they should act in accordance to your demands and expectations. That's what liberation is. So in that way, here we come to the very beginning of Guru Rinpoche's own life, and then this sort of very profound statement that he made in terms of giving his own introduction, which points to the whole fundamental principle of the Vajrayana teachings. And so, continuing from where I had talked about Mahayana, outer Mahayana, as the Vajrayanas say. Now, remember, Mahayana, plain and simple as it is taught, doesn't distinguish it between these two divisions. But the Vajrayana Buddhism, which is not a separate vehicle, but is a further elaboration of the Mahayana, since it elaborates further, allowing us to understand it better, gives us also the possibility of seeing it as outer Mahayana and secret Mahayana. From that perspective, the secret Mahayana, or what is today proper, more generally referred to as Vajrayana, Mantrayana, Tantrayana, Esoteric Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, whatever names you have given it, are all the same. And therefore, here what they refer to is that when a meditator, a person who's really been able to realize the fundamental nature of emptiness, of outer phenomena and inner phenomena, if the realization of the true nature of reality really arises in the mind of such a person, which in the Mahayana tradition would be the accomplishment of the 10th bhumi. There are the 10 progressive bhumis that mature, that depict the maturation of realization. The realization of the highest bhumi, the 10th bhumi, which is called enlightenment, would arise. From the Vajrayana's perspective, it says, at such a moment of realization, that then immediately goes into the attainment of the resultant stage that all Buddhist teachings talk about, which is then called embodying the three kayas. And so in Vajrayana Buddhism, you hear this term very often, the three kayas, Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, and the Nirmanakaya essence. So from the Vajrayana's perspective, the resultant state of the Buddhist teachings is said to be in the actualization of the three kayas. Dhammakaya is generally referred to as mind kaya, or corresponds to the mind. Sambhogakaya corresponds to speech. Nirmanakaya corresponds to the body. In that same further way, Dhammakaya, that which corresponds to the mind, is often also called formlessness of all forms. Sambhogakaya, which is usually correlated to speech, may also be referred to as expressivity, both verbal and nonverbal, the expressive quality. If the expressivity is distorted, it becomes discursive concepts. If the expressivity is not distorted by the ego. That is referred to as the expression of the five wisdoms. Nirmanakaya, what is called the bodhikaya, is then seen as the resultant expression of the Dhammakaya and the Sambhogakaya. Now, to simplify, that is, from the Vajrayana perspective, fundamental nature that is realized as being essentially empty, the resultant state of, let's say, the 10th bhumi, when the bodhisattva, from the Mahayana teachings of knowing the true empty nature of phenomena, outer and inner, that realization arises. The result is in the realization or the recognition of the Dhammakaya essence, formlessness of all forms. So that immediately connects to the true nature of mind in accordance to the Vajrayana teachings. Sambhogakaya is then the natural expressivity of that mind which doesn't have any form. But nevertheless, it's not totally empty. It's very expressive, not only verbally, but it's in its just simple expressivity. The expressivity quality, or the expressive quality of this formless mind, when it is expressed, that is then called the Nirmanakaya emanation. So when we come back, now if you relate that to Padmasambhava's life, and we say Padmasambhava is the emanation of Amitabha Buddha. If you read through some of the more elaborate or the longer biographies of Padmasambhava, it says, from the heart of Amitabha, a seed syllable Shri, shedding bright red light, dissolved or went into and struck the pistol of the lotus, and there immediately arose Padmasambhava as Padmakara, the lotus born, manifesting as an 8-year-old boy. Here in this very simple thing that is written, and people think, whatever did happen? So what we are talking about here is from a mind that realizes the true nature of the emptiness, arises the expressivity of the wisdom, manifest as the true compassion without agenda. Did it happen outside? If you think it, there is an outside. It happened outside in a place called Udayana, in a lake called Dhanakosha, found by a king called Indrabhuti, who was suffering from lack of money, had a kind heart, found a lotus upon which was an 8-year-old boy. Since you posited the reality of there being something outside, you'll have to give freedom for everything else to be also possible. Why not? Your outside can exist, but a lotus can't exist. Your reality can exist, but Dhanakosha cannot exist. So it's up to you. Now if you think, well, no, since everything is mind, say, let's say, supposing a true Mahayana practitioner says, yes, everything is a projection of my own mind. Outside is my mind, inside is my mind. Then yes, Udayana is you. Dhanakosha is your mind stream. The lotus, the Padmasambhava that arises, is the genuine compassion of your heart, and that which can only arise from the pristine wisdom of understanding emptiness that has not been bound and captured by an egoistic, demanding mind. Then you are Padmasambhava. So, was that real? Was this real? The question comes to, what is real? If this is real, then yes, you will have to give reality and the freedom for someone to be real for 3,600 years, born from a lotus. And if you think that doesn't sound very real and possible, then this may not also be that very real and this very possible. It's all up to you. So, short birth of Padmasambhava. I'll say only this much today. If I go on, then it'll be a very long history of Padmasambhava. And it'll go on and on and on. So as far as, you know, what are we going to be talking about? This is the point from where on I think would be good to explore. Okay? So the whole point I would like to make is Vajrayana. If you see Vajrayana in a very concrete way, and you try to box it and compartmentalize it and have structures and empirical history and so forth, You can do it, but it will be making something that is like space fit into a box. So if you buy a very nice brocaded, you know, box, and then you 1, 2, 3 open it and then shut it. Now I've captured space in there. No one can argue the fact that what you have captured in the box is space. But on the other hand, that's not the entirety of space. So Vajrayana points to that fact, is that yes, there is a lot of importance to belief, and you must nurture your belief because that's the capacity with which we have to work at this moment. But there is no reason to be complacent about that kind of a belief that has to be sustained simply because it may not be as you think it is. Questioning that is allowing our mind to becoming able to really expand its vision, expands its ability to hold the reality of whatever it is that is essentially empty in nature. So it is being able to really have a very larger accommodating mind that is able to go beyond the extremes that it supposes it does in the study of Prajnaparamita and the emptiness and so forth. So it's being able to actually see and test yourself how true, how genuine is your understanding of the emptiness nature. And if it is true, it has to be left free to be able to accommodate the universalness, the enormity of whatever it is that is the natural truth, which will, however, be very difficult. And what makes Vajrayana very difficult is because it asks you to break free from familiar patterns. And therefore, that familiar pattern, as long as you seek comfort in it, Vajrayana will always be a very challenging subject. But if you sustain that challenge, if you keep it and become always hesitant with it, remember one thing, your ego itself is never going to say, okay, I give up from today and I'm going to start become brave. The little nudge that you give it has to be from your own basic awareness. And for that, a much more deeper and a much more accurate understanding of Hinayana is absolutely necessary. So the best way to understand Vajrayana is with a thorough understanding of Hinayana.